This year, they'll be doing it with second-year head coach Mike Tomlin, who's making his first trip to the big game, but quarterback Ben Roethlisberger will be calling the signals for the second time. Cardinals quarterback Kurt Warner is looking for his second Super Bowl ring as well. He earned his first in St. Louis as a Ram. The Cardinals are making their first trip to the Super Bowl. The Cards have not won a championship since 1947, when they were the Chicago Cardinals. For NPR News, I'm Mark Neutbar in Pittsburgh.
Top-ranked Rafael Nadal will play number two Roger Federer for the Australian Open Men's Single Tennis Championship on Sunday. Nadal beat his fellow Spaniard Fernando Verdasco in today's semifinal. Serena Williams will play Dinara Safina for the women's title tomorrow. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication. On the web at annenbergfoundation.org.
On February 9th, we hope to encourage 400 listeners to invest in WILL. Your dollars will help AM 580 build a better picture of what's going on in your world and how it will affect you. Hi, I'm station manager Jay Pierce, asking you to call in with a pledge on February 9th, our one-day Monday fund drive, or give online now at willpledge.org. Thank you.
Programs on WILL are made possible with support from the Friends of WILL and from Sinfonia de Camera, presenting English Garden with Shaba Erde on viola on Saturday, February 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The program features works by Elgar, Walton, and Vaughan Williams.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Well, in keeping with our tradition here, our interest here on this program, I've always tried to find things to talk about that we have never discussed before. In this part of the show, we'll be talking in part about the rise of the independent trucker here in the United States. This is a special breed of truck driver that really began to appear in this country, say, in the 1920s. And we're talking about rural independent truckers, people who were fiercely independent and, among other things, helped to bring low-priced food and eventually other kind of consumer goods to a greater number of Americans. But we're going to talk about more than that. We're going to make some connections between the agricultural policies of the New Deal, the rise of this kind of individual, someone who has been raised to a kind of mythic status here in the United States, and talk a little bit about what all of that means for American politics today. And our guest for the program is Shane Hamilton. He is professor of history at the University of Georgia. His area of interest is 20th century U.S. history, and is particularly interested in things like agricultural and rural social history, and also the history of technology. And we'll be talking about some of what you will find in his book, Trucking Country, and the subtitle is The Road to America's Walmart Economy. The Princeton University Press is the publisher. The book is out and is available, and certainly if you're interested in taking a look at it, you can do that. Also, this morning as we talk, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. We always give people the opportunity to join in the conversation, make comments, ask questions. All we ask of callers is people just try to keep their comments brief, but anybody can call in. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number and the call's on us. And that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you want to join in, you can give us a call. Professor Hamilton, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Just to sort of start where we are now and maybe work backwards a little bit, I think that you refer to some of the kind of political analysis that's going on now, where people are asking a question about taking a look at rural conservatives, people who are politically conservatives, live in rural area, and how it is that they connect generally to the conservative movement. And a lot of people have asked this question, well, in a sense, you could understand why cultural conservatives might connect to the bigger conservative movement. But that, in a sense, the interest of these people, the kind of people that we're talking about, don't seem to line up very well always with the interests of, let us say, urban economic conservatives. And there's a lot has been written about this, and in particular, you one book that's had a lot of attention, and you actually refer to it, is the book, Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas? People asking this question, well, why should rural people, even if they are conservative, identify in a larger sense with conservatives because it doesn't seem that their economic interests line up? And it seems that I'm babbling on here for quite a bit, but it seems that perhaps there are some, if you look back to the kind of history that you do in your book, that might indeed supply some answers to that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's an essential irony in modern conservatism that, you know, cultural conservatives really call for big government. You know, they may consider themselves, you know, in favor of a smaller government, smaller taxes, and so forth. But in reality, they want an activist, you know, state to actually police what they see as traditional values. And that often conflicts with, you know, the more economic conservatism that's based on, you know, smaller government, less taxes, less regulation. But that also, that economic conservatism, as we've seen in the past, the recent presidential administration that just ended, often goes hand in hand with big spending. You know, even the same government that can say that, you know, they're conservative will drive up enormous debts sometimes. So the question is for, you know, these people that, you know, Tom Frank says, what's the matter with Kansas? You know, hardworking middle Americans. What he wants to know is, why is it that people in, say, Kansas, who, you know, spearheaded the populist movement and the progressive era movements in the early 20th century, late 19th century, how is it that the same people seem to have become extremely conservative in our own time? And he sees it as a cultural issue. But I argue that, in fact, the dramatic changes in the U.S. economy over the 20th century really had a bigger part to play.
Mm. Well, let's go back and talk a little bit about agricultural policy in the New Deal. And certainly now, because of the place that we are, a lot of people are looking back to this point in American history and looking at what government did and how government responded and so forth. But it seems, to me at least, that there hasn't really been very much attention that I have seen focused on agricultural policy in the New Deal, although that was one of the very first things that the Roosevelt administration actually did.
Right.
Can you just give us a little bit of a summary of what it is that they did in terms of trying to help the farming sector?
Well, you know, a little bit of a summary is hard because it was an enormous, extremely complex set of policies. In essence, though, the farm policies of the New Deal were in response to the farm depression, which began well before the stock market crash of 1929. It's an essential point that, you know, when I'm teaching my classes here at the University of Georgia, my students have to understand that the stock market crash did not cause the Great Depression. There are a whole host of causes, and historians argue about it, but one definite aspect of it was the collapse of the rural economy in the 1920s. So even under Herbert Hoover, who's often remembered as this inactive president, there were significant efforts made at the federal level to try and fix the farm crisis. But they really took off and got significant funding and legislative backing under Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. And the effort was to keep farms in business using government payments directly, basically, to farmers to reduce their production. The idea being that if they produced less, crops would sell for more, and then farmers would make more income. The problem with that, one of the problems with that, is that that conflicted with other New Deal efforts that were aimed at boosting workers' consuming power. Workers in cities had to buy food. So if the government is basically going out and handing farmers checks to reduce their production to drive up prices, that hurts urban consumers. So there was a conflict in the New Deal, a very central conflict that came to play a large role in the politics of the New Deal for the next 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really interesting because does that suggest that maybe some of what we think of today as a kind of urban-rural political divide goes back to this point?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I see that as essential. So these economic debates about policy regarding farm policy, farm and food policy, I think bedeviled the New Deal from the start, even before the start, really. but certainly from the start and through into the 1960s and 1970s that really set the stage for the rise of conservative sensibility in rural America. So it's not that in the 1970s suddenly rural people got upset about the cultural issues that they, you know, they felt that America was declining in the 1960s or that, you know, there was a backlash against the civil rights movement or anything like that. But that there was a deep mistrust of the federal government and of economic liberalism through most of the 20th century.
Well, let me ask you then to talk a little bit more about New Deal ag policy. And again, as you say, this is complicated. But so if one just took a look at the agricultural sector, at people who were raising food and involved in trying to get it to market and get it into the hands of consumers. If you ask this question, who primarily, and I'm thinking about maybe the sort of divide here between really small farmers and really big farmers,
mm-hmm.
who primarily benefited from the ag policies of the New Deal?
Right. So if one problem with the New Deal farm policies was that they split urban consumers from rural farmers in many ways, it also led to splits between small farmers and big farmers. You know, there's most of the money, for various reasons, was funneled into the pockets of the largest farmers, the largest commercial farmers. And particularly in the South, large landowners basically pocketed the government checks and often kicked their sharecroppers off the land, which helped to spur, you know, the so-called Okie migration during the Dust Bowl era. You know, people moving westward, picking up and as remembered and the Grapes of Wrath and so forth. Many other folks, you know, had to figure out what to do. Just as prices were declining, the government check didn't necessarily help them out very much, especially if they were small farmers. So many looked, you know, to other opportunities. Many moved to cities. Others, as I point out in the book, became truck drivers, looking for a way to stay in the rural economy, but couldn't do so as farmers.
I'm thinking now how many different directions we go in from here. Let me then take one more step here and talk a little bit about at this time, maybe right around the time that you look at where we're starting to see the birth and the rise of the independent trucker and his connection with farmers, particularly smaller farmers. What would have been the predominant way that agricultural commodities were moved around?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is part of the, you know, the farm policies were developed in an economic world, and much of the structure of that economic world, literally the structure, the technology, shaped the ways that government could think about the policies that could be put in place. So the essential structure was that most farmers, by the 1920s for sure, got their goods to market by railroad. How they got it to the railroad, you know, could be either by horse or car or mule, and increasingly in the 1920s by truck. But there emerged in the 1920s, 1930s, especially as roads were being built, which is another component of the New Deal. As roads were being built, as bigger trucks were coming out, gasoline was very cheap in the 1930s, very different from our own time. A lot of farmers began loading up, you know, even just a Model T, which we think of maybe as a rather small automobile, but at the time it, you know, could be modified to become basically a pretty heavy carrier of things like milk cans or even cattle. I've got some pictures of farmer truckers who loaded up cattle on the back of a Model T. And they'd take those into town or maybe to the railhead. Increasingly, this became what we now know as long-haul trucking.
Hmm. It's a really interesting story. Let me just quickly pause long enough to introduce again our guest, Shane Hamilton. He's assistant professor of history at the University of Georgia. And what we're talking about here is a story that he explores in his book, Trucking Country. The subtitle is The Road to America's Walmart Economy. It's published by the Princeton University Press. And as I mentioned, it connects a number of things. It connects the development of agricultural policy in the New Deal, what that meant for farming in this country, the rise of independent truckers and what that all, perhaps we can say what that all means for American politics today. Again, questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, now, you know, we're sort of used to, if you drive on the interstates or you drive on main rural roads, you're certainly used to now seeing big trucks. That was not always the case, and we start to see them become more common in this period you're talking about, say, like the 20s and the 30s. Can you talk a little bit about how exactly this got started and who these people, these independent truckers, who were they?
Well, you know, independent truckers early, when I say independent truckers, I'm actually referring to a couple of different things. In the 1920s, 1930s, early 1930s, most truckers would have been independent in the sense that they owned their own trucks and probably didn't belong to a union, namely the Teamsters Union. So independent trucking, it often just began 1920s, 30s, even in the 40s, you know, somebody who had some kind of access to enough cash, you know, whether it's, you know, from serving in the military and getting a, you know, bonus payment or something like that, or selling the farm, which is quite common in the 1930s, would go out and buy a truck. Many others got into it because firms like General Motors and Ford offered credit in the 1930s. Even with the hard times of the Depression, they offered pretty what seemed like generous credit terms to, you know, purchase on installments a truck. And so for a lot of young men who didn't have much more opportunity, it seemed, in farming in the 1930s, 1940s, trucking seemed like a good way to make a decent living.
There are a number of, I suppose, points of conflict here that arise, and I guess you talked about the fact that these people, by and large, were not members of the Teamsters Union. How did organized labor look at these people?
Well, a key thing that we haven't really talked about yet is the rise of the regulatory system for trucking in 1935. You know, it's very important right now. I don't know, probably 3 years ago, if I said the word regulation to my students in a class, they would just look at me as if I had come from another planet. But now, of course, we hear the word regulation and deregulation all the time. It's on everybody's lips, something that people have to understand. One of the key things that happened during the New Deal was regulation by the Interstate Commerce Commission of the trucking industry. And this entailed many things. The effort was aimed at overseeing the trucking industry to keep, try and keep businesses from going out of business constantly left and right, which was happening in the early days of the New Deal. Trucking firms were just going out of business all over the place. So regulation was meant to stabilize the industry. It wasn't necessarily intended to benefit organized labor, but in reality, it did help the Teamsters Union to organize many of the nation's truckers and long-haul truckers. And from 1935 into the mid-1950s, the Teamsters Union basically became the single largest and most powerful union in the country.
And there was, though, for these people, these independent truckers, particularly people we're talking about who are hauling agricultural products, in terms of the regulations, there was a niche here that they could fill. In fact, really was the one niche that they had to fill, and that was hauling commodities, because that was one area of shipping that wasn't regulated.
Right. That's a core point of the book, is that in 1935, when the New Dealers put in place this regulatory system, farm interests in Congress lobbied to say, well, you can't regulate, you know, the small independent trucker who's just a farmer, you know, carrying a couple cattle into a market on a Model T. You know, the government can't come in and, you know, tell him where he can haul and how much he can charge. He's just an independent, you know, farmer. And that kind of agrarian language in the 1930s went over successfully, and there was an exemption made for regulation for anyone who was hauling agricultural products. And as I show in the book, through the 1930s and 40s, that exemption was expanded to include, you know, not only some live cattle in the back of a truck, but, you know, frozen foods, frozen processed chicken, which doesn't sound exactly like just an agricultural commodity. That's a pretty manufactured product, even if it is food. Mm. So this exemption really opened the way for rural truckers, by and large rural truckers, to be hauling goods without any regulatory oversight, basically skirting the entire New Deal, not just in terms of federal power, but also avoiding the Teamsters Union, which really relied on that regulatory system to enroll many of its members.
So did the Teamsters consider this to be a threat?
The Teamsters always were opposed to it. I mean, in 1935, the Teamsters really didn't have any say in shaping the regulatory system that emerged during the New Deal. They came to be powerful later. And through the 1940s, 1950s, they repeatedly made efforts in Congress to fight this agricultural exemption, to get rid of it, to expand the regulatory oversight to all truckers and try and basically enroll these independents or so-called gypsies. Daniel Tobin, the head of the Teamsters in the 1930s, claimed that these truckers were trash, the trash on the road. And so there was definitely a tension between the Teamsters and organized drivers and these so-called independents.
I would expect that also the people who represented the railroad industry, that interest, that I also would expect would be a very powerful political lobby, that as this grew, and I suppose as it, I don't know how long it would take really to become a real challenge, but at some point I would think that they would be very unhappy about this too.
Yeah, the railroads, you know, it's interesting. In the beginning, the railroads were one of the biggest promoters in the 1920s and teens, 20s, even in the 30s. Railroads were one of the biggest promoters of the trucking industry because at the time, you know, this is before the interstate highway system. Many rural areas really don't have reliable roads. They thought that trucks would be, you know, vehicles for getting goods to their railheads more effectively. They didn't really see railroads and trucks being competitive necessarily. But increasingly through the 1930s, it became clear that trucks, especially those that were using this agricultural exemption, were going out and gathering many of the railroad's most profitable items. Things like milk, for instance. Milk, you know, first began being delivered into major cities by express trains in the late 19th century. And it was a highly profitable line for the railroads. People were willing to pay good money for fresh, clean, refrigerated milk. By the 1930s, truckers were really taking over that business and leaving the railroads out in the cold.
Mm. Well, I'm sure that railroads are still today are involved in shipping large amounts of agricultural commodities. But at some point, if you charted this on a graph and you looked at the role that railroads played in shipping agricultural products and that trucks played, is there going to be some point where you got two lines and they're going to cross and that the trucking is then going to start to become more important and will take the place that had been held previously by the railroads?
Yeah, the key point is in the mid-1950s, right around the time of the beginning of the construction of the interstate highway system. But even before that, the trucks were, you know, I mean, today, yes, of course, railroads still carry a lot of agricultural commodities. But by and large, the rails tend to carry low-value, big tonnage freight, like, say, grain, whereas the truckers were hauling the higher value items like meat and milk especially, and as I also focus on in the book, frozen foods, which were supposedly the most revolutionary idea in the history of food in the 1930s. So the trucks, even though they were hauling less in terms of tonnage over a certain number of miles, they were increasingly hauling the most profitable items. So that really hurt the railroad's bottom lines. It made it more and more difficult for the railroads to earn the profits that they had grown accustomed to earlier in the 20th century. And so that's the nature of the competition that emerged in the mid-20th century, in the 1950s especially. Railroads sensed that the truckers were getting all the valuable freight.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, just to introduce again, is Shane Hamilton. He is assistant professor of history at the University of Georgia. He's interested in 20th century American history and specifically things like agricultural and rural social history and also the history of technology. And certainly that all comes together in this story that we are talking about here this morning, a subject of his book, Trucking Country, the subtitle, The Road to America's Walmart Economy. It is published by the Princeton University Press. And as I explained, it takes a look at a number of things and how they're connected, the agricultural policies of the New Deal, the rise of the independent trucker, and perhaps also what that means for American politics today and economics today. All of that there in the book. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just also to take a step back here, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what's happening here now at this point where we're talking about, again, I'm going back to the point of the New Deal, where you explained initially that one of the first things that the administration did, the Roosevelt administration here, in trying to address the economic problems of the country was with a big and very complicated agricultural policy. This was, as you explained, in response to the fact that there was a depression going on in rural America, with something that really was well underway and in place before the stock market crash. And it seemed that the attitudes of people in rural areas, at least initially, toward this kind of big government policy was positive, that they had this idea that that was going to help them, but that eventually, and maybe it actually didn't take all that long, before they started to change their ideas, and perhaps now we get to this idea where it tends to be more the case that rural people are more conservative. They're actually believe more strongly in maybe in smaller government. They're skeptical about the idea, you know, the old joke about how the government is here to help you. What sort of role did particularly, I guess, in New Deal ag policy play perhaps in changing the attitudes of rural people toward government and whether it was good or bad and what it could do for them?
Well, you know, that's the real kicker. That, you know, even today, we essentially have the basic outlines of New Deal farm policy are still in place. Along with Social Security, these are really the only two programs of major weight from the New Deal era that have continued all the way through to our own time. And so rural people, by and large, still appreciate government support. I mean, even those who are diehard libertarians, you know, refuse to believe the government can do anything good, that it's always part of the problem, not the solution, are afraid to, you know, go off of government payments, you know, that help to support the farm economy. So you've got that going along. But what I show in the book is how even as that, you know, kind of refusal in some ways to acknowledge the contradiction in their own views about big government that continues in farm policy. In terms of other policies, particularly regulation, you know, this word that by the 1970s became a dirty, dirty word, was despised by rural people all the way through the mid-20th century.
Well, we have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. We'd certainly invite others here in Champaign-Urbana. 333-9455 is the number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Effingham, line number 4.
Yes, is it all right to bring some nostalgia into the conversation?
I suppose so. Go ahead.
Okay. I grew up in Terre Haute, Indiana. And the terms that your guest has been using, the milk train, and then in those days there were refrigerator cars, and hobos were supposedly opening up the tops and going in to get at the meat and frozen stuff in those. And when I were young, there weren't very many cars, and the railroad and the passenger train was right behind where I lived, a huge yards. East of where I lived, in New York Central mainly. And I guess the brings to my memory those things that growing up with that and then the understanding from adults what they were doing. The most tragic was the CNEI, which ran behind within two blocks of where I lived, a milk train. I heard you mention that, a milk train, and a returning troop train. This would have been in the 1940s. Collided, and all the buzz that these soldiers had survived were on their way home, and and some were killed in that collision. You know, those tragic things, but the traffic was heavy. And finally, trucks and trucking. I trucked for 25 years on light delivery, hauling mail that had formerly gone on mail trains. And then the rise of small trucking firms, UPS and FedEx and all those, which has taken, you know, a huge chunk of the mail that formerly had went on those trains and buy other meth, you know, lighter trucks. But I just want to contribute that, Dave. I mean, I go back a long way, but that was fresh in my memory as a kid, you know, and all those events and the chugging and the steam engine and all that sort of thing. It was very dramatic. Thank you very much.
Okay. I don't know if you want to comment on any of that particularly. Certainly, it says something about how things have changed.
It does, but actually, I think the nostalgia element is, we should take it quite seriously because, you know, railroads are often aspects of nostalgia. And it's very interesting, you know, this huge industrial machinery that in the late 19th century many people envisioned as an octopus, you know, this trust of, you know, East Coast elitist capitalists were running these railroads and, you know, potentially putting farmers' livelihoods at stake. By the 1930s, 40s, as trucks begin to replace railroads, people start to remember the railroads rather more fondly. And, you know, there's no nostalgia for truckers, although maybe that's coming out now as people are reviving the 70s and thinking about the 70s again when the trucker became the, you know, the bandit, the renegade cowboy. But the nostalgia thing, I think, is actually quite interesting.
Well, I do. I also think it's interesting that the fact that at least at some point that the independent trucker was elevated to the status of a popular culture hero.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's absolutely essential that, so we've been talking about farm policy and regulation. A key thing is that the owner-operator trucker, who is the guy who ends up being hailed as a hero in the 1960s and especially the 1970s, is a product of this New Deal oversight, or lack of oversight, really, of rural truckers. So you've got a bunch of country boys, really, you know, out on the highways, avoiding, you know, federal economic oversight, by and large, not becoming members of unions. By the 1970s, as people, you know, outside of the trucking industry and in all kinds of social walks of life begin to mistrust the government, you know, from Watergate to Vietnam to everything else, begin sensing that the American dream is maybe somehow collapsing in the 1970s with stagflation, you know, as incomes are stagnating but prices are going up. This trucker who's, you know, not in the centers of power, whether it's in big corporations or big government or in big labor, is upheld as this kind of anti-hero in a way, both a hero and an anti-hero, because most of the truckers depicted, such as the truckers in the Smokey and the Bandit movies and in Convoy, starring Kris Kristofferson, you know, are depicted as these outlaw figures.
Mm-hmm. Well, did these people... Was this a reflection that the independent trucker and the way people thought about them and the way they thought about themselves, was that a kind of a reflection of anti-union sentiment, or did that help to actually create anti-union sentiment?
You know, it's both. And it's not just sentiment. In terms of being a reflection of anti-union sentiment, yes, I think that there were, you know, many workers, whether they belonged to unions or not, many people who actually belonged to unions came to very much dislike their unions in the 1970s, including some members of the Teamsters after their various scandals through the 50s and 60s. But one core argument I make is that these independent truckers were actually helping to transform the economy in ways that I call it the transformation to the American Walmart economy, mm-hmm. was driving down wages and driving down prices for goods at the same time. And so there's a sense in the 1970s, especially, that unions, with their high wages, you know, especially auto workers, were somehow driving up the cost of living. That you know, unions were one of the core reasons for the stagflation that America was witnessing in the 1970s. And so long-haul truckers were lionized or heroized because they seemed to be able to point the direction to a new kind of economy where unions were no longer necessary, where hardworking folks like these truckers would help provide the goods that America wanted cheaply. Hmm.
Let's talk with someone else here in Urbana, where we are, line two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, Professor Hamilton.
Hello.
If you could touch on the question of Dan Tobin and Farrell Dobbs in the Northern States Trucking Union and the struggle in Minneapolis and St. Paul in 1936, the Northern States Trucking Union and the Socialist Workers' Party took over the city of Minneapolis for 3 days in a general strike.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also should touch on the question of Henry A. Wallace, the Secretary of Agriculture. And I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, a key point about the Teamsters in the 1930s, you know, really the Teamsters Union was an older union that emerged as in the late 19th, early 20th century, organizing city deliverers, you know, small T Teamsters, deliverers of milk and bread and coal and so forth, delivering things from wholesale centers out to people's homes or to retail stores. But the 1930s, people like Farrell Dobbs took a different view. They thought, you know, why not organize anyone who drives a truck or in many ways is just involved in the transportation industry generally, the trucking industry generally, rather than focusing just on city workers. Let's try and get out into the countryside and organize all these people who are driving long haul. Daniel Tobin, who had been president for some time of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, did not like that idea. That's why he called the over-the-road truckers gypsies and trash. But Dobbs, also Jimmy Hoffa to a large extent, various other, Dave Beck was another organizer who really went out and fought hard and often literally fought hard, used strong-arm tactics to get truckers into the Teamsters Union.
I'm really interested in the fact that here we have two, as we've talked, we have two contradictory notions that on the one hand, people want cheap goods, and on the other hand, they want high wages, and that one might argue that you can't have both, but that in fact, this change in this basic transportation shipping mechanisms that we had here in this country somehow were involved in both of those things. That is, they were both somehow involved in keeping the prices. Initially, I suppose it would have been prices for food, and then maybe later prices for other kind of consumer goods, helping to keep those prices low. And at the same time, that there was some way in which they were also working in the opposite direction when it came to what people were paid for their work.
You know, it comes down to a central question, and it's a question we're facing right now, is how do you sustain the American dream? And there are different components of the American dream. Many times people think of it as the opportunity to get rich. But generally people think of it as having, you know, a secure economic situation. You know, maybe owning a home, having a job, a steady job that isn't going to be pulled away from you at any given time. The New Deal, one of the central goals of the New Deal, if not the central goal, was to sustain that purchasing power of average American people. And there were various methods doing it. You know, supporting organized labor was a core one. Various regulatory policies aimed at stabilizing business were another. You know, even the efforts to boost farm prosperity were all about this. What we see since really the 1970s, 1980s, is a sense that government should not be responsible for sustaining the American dream, that in fact businesses should be doing it. And so I show how trucking helped to actually drive that shift, that companies like Walmart, and not just Walmart, all kinds of other companies, began to take on the responsibility for keeping, you know, the American dream seemingly alive. But focusing rather than on keeping wages high, they focused on keeping prices low. So trucking was essential to making that possible.
Mm-hmm. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We'll talk with some other folks here, and let me again just introduce the guest, Shane Hamilton. He is assistant professor of history at the University of Georgia. He's particularly interested in 20th century American history and things like agricultural and rural social history and the history of technology. And all those things really come together in the story that we're trying to tell, or that he is telling here this morning. And if you'd like to read this book that deals with this, the title is Trucking Country, The Road to America's Walmart Economy, and it's published by the Princeton University Press. We have a couple of other people here ready to go to talk with us. Let's go next to the community of Belgium, and that's our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning, sirs. As a youth, I worked in the center part of the state for a farmer, and he derived a substantial portion of his income as being a trucker also. He raised grain and hogs and cattle and stuff like that, but he had also haul from rural Illinois to Peoria, livestock, hogs, pigs, whatever, somebody, sheep, whatever person wanted. And he always spoke, unfortunately just passed away. He was like 97 years old. So he lived clear through this, and he was involved with this because he always had a problem with the ICC and his trucking permit. And he always spoke of times that were really rough back in the beginning. From what you said, people would strong arm him and stuff like that. And he wasn't driving a large truck. We're talking about not like a semi-truck. We're talking, you know, one that was one piece and you had to load cattle onto it. I don't know if you've ever seen what I'm talking about.
A straight
about.
Truck, yeah.
Yeah, just a straight truck. And he always talked about how difficult it was not only to deal with the government and getting his thing, but also dealing with the people who didn't want him doing this, you know what I mean? And I assume that's what you're talking about. But he just used it as a supplement to his income because the farm income wasn't enough to deal with it. He was getting pigs were paid 10 cents a pound for him at this time. This was in the early 60s. And he said he couldn't survive if it wasn't for the trucking he did. Was that a very common thing for in the Midwest here?
Extremely common, and not just in the Midwest. All throughout the country became one of the way. I mean, for many of the rural truckers who went into it, that's how they started. Is it was just a sideline to their farming. You know, maybe they'd start hauling for their neighbors, and then maybe make a little bit bigger business, and then they'd face a choice between, you know, going full time into the trucking business or continuing this mix and match of farming and trucking. That's extremely common. And it is interesting, though, that you know the reason he was able to do that is because he had this agricultural exemption. He didn't actually have to register with the ICC. He had to follow safety rules and there were, you know, basic regulations that he had to follow. But ICC really made it very difficult for most small firms to get into trucking. That's why it ended up being cornered by giant firms like Roadway and Yellow and Consolidated Freightways.
Well, I remember he always had to have the number on the side of his truck, and he was always complaining about them.
Yeah, he had to register and he had to pay taxes.
Oh.
He probably wasn't liking that part.
Probably not. Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Let's go on to another caller. This is Leroy, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I think your answer to the previous question probably answers mine. My question was, you said that when the farmers were being bought out by the larger farmers, that they turned to trucking to make a decent living. And my question is kind of twofold. One is, did they make a decent living in the 30s and the 40s? And today, are independent truckers better off than they were in those days, than the beginning of independent trucking, or are they about the same? And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
That's a great question. In the 30s and 40s, especially in the 30s, before regulation came in, before the Teamsters grew strong, trucking for anyone was insanely difficult and did not pay very well. It was seen as maybe a way to make a living. It was lionized in the movie They Drive by Night, a Warner Brothers film from 1940. But it was a very tough job. When the Teamsters came in, it really did help many truckers secure good pay. And through the 40s and 50s, especially, organized drivers, so-called company drivers, did very well, you know, got pensions and health benefits and other things because of their membership in the union. Independent truckers, so-called owner-operators, did okay in the 40s and 50s. In the 60s, they did exceedingly well for various reasons, one main one being low cost of fuel and another being the interstate highway system making it possible for them to haul more loads. Owner-operator truckers did quite well. The 70s, with the fuel crisis, that all collapsed, which led to a massive uprising, several, actually, giant shutdowns by truckers who violently blockaded the nation's highways and demanded that the regulatory system be obliterated. They believed that that would help them earn a better living. And in fact, the trucking industry was deregulated in the late 1970s. And early 1980s. We often remember Ronald Reagan as the great deregulator, but it was in fact Jimmy Carter that put the deregulation through. And in the wake of that, since then, long-haul trucking, independent truckers, now compose something like 400,000 of the nation's workers. They're not necessarily employees. They're often owner-operators. And some of them do okay, or some of them even do quite well. But it's an extremely risky business where, you know, you may end up getting wiped out, as many people did. Many truckers just were wiped out by the recent rise in fuel prices. So whether it's a more rewarding job today than it was in the 1960s, I guess you'd have to bring in some nostalgia. But in terms of economics, pure, you know, numbers, 1960s truckers were doing better. Owner-operator truckers were doing better than they are today.
Just, I'm curious if you compare the numbers of independents with people who work for some large trucking company, how do they compare?
In terms of numbers, today the vast majority of truckers are in so-called independents. Mm-hmm. They might work for a larger trucking company, like J.B. Hunt, for instance. Which only hires, it doesn't hire employed truckers. It doesn't pay them wages. It pays, it contracts with them. FedEx does a similar thing. So most of the truckers today are so-called independents in a way, even if they actually work for a larger corporation. But the risk, the economic risk really is they bear it rather than the bigger company.
Yeah, they own the truck. It's the FedEx is, I think probably a lot of people maybe don't realize that if you, when you become a FedEx driver, you've got to buy the truck.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they are, by doing that, they're avoiding unionization for one thing. They're avoiding having to, you know, comply with regulations on employment law and so forth. They are able to, you know, treat the drivers as small independent businessmen, which many truckers value. They value that sense of independence, but, you know, that independence is often questionable when, you know, they can't produce loads on their own. They certainly depend on FedEx to get them their loads.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else in the time that remains here. We have a caller in Aurora, line 4 right here. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Interesting topic. I used to be a trucker, and I got out of it in the 70s, early 80s, because of what you were talking about, gas prices. I actually hauled hay with somebody out west. It was kind of a co-op thing, but I know several people who still do it out west, and you're right that nowadays, it's hard to be, you know, to drive an 18-wheeler no matter what. They got you regulated to the point of no return. Plus, you know, if you lose a tire, or, you know, the recaps and all that, just the maintenance on your truck is just very unaffordable. But what is happening out west, I had to bring this up, is that they're turning the alfalfa fields into what I thought was interesting, because I haven't lived out there for 20 years, that they're turning it into different kinds of farming and vineyards. A lot of vineyards are popping up in the southwest desert area, and there seems to be kind of a mini boom for trucking out there. A lot of people I've seen recently have picked up a couple number of trucks cheap and are trying to do it. I don't know if you've heard of that or not. I'm California and Arizona. I was just curious to see. But I know the maintenance of vehicles is just astronomical.
Right. No, I haven't. Well, actually, I think I have heard about some of the efforts in Arizona. But that is popping up in lots of places. And it is an interesting possibility. You know, there's this a strong local food movement coming along, really questioning the whole supermarket model of national food distribution or even global food distribution. And what role trucks would play in that. You know, it's entirely possible that trucking could go back to being more like it was in the 1930s, 40s, where it's more localized, more regional, and that, you know, we turn back to rails, which are far more efficient in terms of fuel use for shipping things all the way across country. But as of now, it certainly seems, you know, with Walmart and other companies, their distribution centers are set up in such a way that they're utterly reliant on long-haul trucks. You know, most food distribution, most agricultural distribution couldn't even go by rail today because the centers have been built to exist on highways.
Hmm. What was that here? We have maybe a minute or two left, but was that for big agribusiness to embrace trucking? Was that something that they had to think about, or right away did they see that that was to their advantage and that that was going to become extremely important?
It depended on the agribusiness. You know, we often don't think of supermarkets as agribusiness, but they really are essentially tied to the industrial agriculture system we have. For supermarkets and for meat packers, it was really in the 1950s, 60s, it was essential to shift to trucking because they were able to get their products delivered straight to their warehouses and straight from those warehouses then to their retail stores. And you know, I don't know if you've ever been to a supermarket that was located by a rail line, but I've never seen one.
Not that I can think of, no. Well, it's interesting. You're apparently now working on a project or have been working on a project for a while that eventually is going to be another book that looks at the American supermarket?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, looking at this essential connection between supermarkets and, you know, the farmlands upon which they depend. And really seeing the rise of the supermarket as connected to these transformations in industrial agriculture in America in the 1930s through the 1950s, and looking at how there were efforts made to spread that model around the world.
I think, I guess one of the things that interests me here is you've taken and we've just sketched it out. People can read it in greater detail, but we've taken the story where there seem to be a number of disparate parts, different elements that though come together in interesting ways to result in some really big changes in America's economy and what that means for people who work and people who have to buy food. And that maybe we don't quite always see these kinds of connections, but it takes this sort of long look back over a fairly long period of time. Or maybe it actually wasn't that long. Maybe we're just talking about a few decades and we saw this kind of change happen.
Yeah, it is only a few decades, but it's a remarkable transformation. You know, in the 1930s, many Americans produced at least some of their own food. Today, very few do. You know, even farmers don't eat their own food. Everything they produce is sold to be exported out to another state, at least, if not out to the rest of the world. So it's a dramatic transformation, and I think that, you know, looking back at the history of trucking and supermarkets and really thinking about the politics and the economic changes in which they were involved helps us to understand our own world and our own time much more effectively.
And if people would like to read more in detail of this story, look for the book Trucking Country, The Road to America's Walmart Economy. It's published by the Princeton University Press by our guest, Shane Hamilton. He is assistant professor of history at the University of Georgia. And Professor Hamilton, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
This program, Focus 580, is supported in part by Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982, now with 4 area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com. We will take a break, as we usually do at this point, and we'll be back with more Focus 580. First, though, an update on the markets and news, so stay tuned.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists. More information is at agrigold.com or at 800-262-7333. Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. There is a lot of green on the screen. Prices rallying today. Let's go right to the pits. March wheat in Kansas City at 614 and a quarter, up 6 1/4. At the Chicago Board of Trade, March wheat at 582 and 3/4, up 4 3/4. July 607, up 4 1/4. March corn 383 3/4, up 2. May 394 3/4, up 1 3/4. July 405 1/4, up 1 1/2. December 429 1/2, up 2 1/4. March crude oil 41.90, up 46 cents. February ethanol 158 5/10, down 1/10. The February RBOB at 123 3/10 is up 2 1/10. March beans 982 3/4, up 12 1/4. May 989 1/4, up 11 1/2. July 996 3/4.